Today we're going to be covering chapters 19 through 31 in the Exodus story. Last week we looked at chapters 1 through 18. And if you look on page 32, you'll see the structure of Exodus. The central turning point of the book and the hinge of it is where Moses leads the Israelites to the base of Mount Sinai. And so the storyline really shifts at that point. Up to that point, it has been a story of Israel's deliverance from bondage in Egypt. And you have essentially three key points. God is Redeemer, and it's not just God, it's Yahweh is their Redeemer, Yahweh is their Deliverer, and Yahweh is their Healer. That's the three main points. Over and over again in the first section of the book of Exodus, it says Yahweh wants to be known. And he wants to be known not only to Israel, but he also wants to be known to the nation of Egypt. He wants to show that he has a mighty hand, and he also wants to be known to the nations of the world. So the Exodus event is actually a mighty display of God's power so that the world may know that, number one, that he is powerful and that he is the one that's in charge, and also that he loves the nation of Israel and has redeemed them to be his chosen and special people. So when we shift gears to chapter 19, where we're talking about the giving of the covenant on Mount Sinai, we're beginning to form that relationship of a covenanted relationship between Yahweh and the nation of Israel. It's not to say that Yahweh didn't have a relationship with these people before. He obviously did. He told Moses to tell them, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm the same God that has been relating to you since the time of your fathers and the patriarchs. But I am now entering into a new component or aspect of that relationship. I have, in a sense, purchased you. That's the language of redemption. I've purchased you from bondage and slavery. And now you are mine. I've delivered you and I have healed you. And so I want to begin this covenanted relationship with you as my people. So in the wilderness of Sinai, and I'm on page 33 now of the handout, Yahweh called Israel to a special and unique role among the peoples of the earth. Yahweh had made himself known to Israel and Egypt, for that matter, as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as Redeemer, as Warrior, Deliverer, and Healer. But now that Israel has seen who Yahweh is through his mighty acts and come to have a trust in him as their Deliverer and Healer, he is now going to take them to this new relationship through the covenant that he will make with them on Mount Sinai. One way to think about it is, and the language of marriage is actually one that is used at times with the nation of Israel. God refers to Israel sometimes as his spouse. But there is an existing relationship with a couple before their wedding day. They're in love with each other. They have a relationship. They're engaged, maybe even. But then that wedding day is the ceremonial moment where it becomes a marriage. That's not a bad way of looking at what happens at Mount Sinai. It's wedding day. It's the day when the covenant is given and when the vows are taken between Yahweh and his people. And we're going to see that as we go through this. But their new relationship would have three components. And we get those components in the verses that I've quoted on the left side of your page there. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So the relationship that Yahweh is establishing with Israel has these three components. It will first involve a privileged status. Israel would be Yahweh's treasured possession among all the peoples of the world. Secondly, Israel was to be given a high calling as a kingdom of priests. And this is a role of an intermediary between Yahweh and the nations of the world. They are to administrate God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven and be the ambassadors of God's reconciling love and grace to the nations of the world through the ministry of the temple complex primarily. But thirdly, the privileged status and the high calling to be this intermediary to the nations of the world would also come with a demand for a unique and special character. They were called to be a holy nation. In other words, they should live differently from all the other nations of the world, and that would include a very high moral standard and a high calling, but they should also, just by the way that they carried themselves, live set apart and separate from the people of the world culturally and ethnically. So on Mount Sinai, the Israelites camped at the base of this mountain for about a year. It is more often in their camping as they go through the wilderness wanderings that they have these dramatic revelations from God. The way these next books of the Bible, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, they're, as the storyline develops, they camp, then they travel, and they camp, and they travel, and they camp. It's in the camping moments. It's in the pauses that God reveals himself to them dramatically. And I think that's applicable to our lives. It's not when we're busy and we're moving that we actually have the moments that we hear God speaking. It's not to say he's not working in our lives or leading us and directing us. He certainly was leading and directing Israel in their wanderings during those times. But it's in those moments when we stop and we have that moment, like the psalmist says, where we're still, that we can begin to know that God is God in our lives. So this is one of those occasions. This is a big occasion where they stopped. The location of the mountain is no longer precisely known. If you were to look on maps where they try to locate Mount Sinai, there often is a question mark. You'll see there are traditional sites where people think that Mount Sinai was, but those are often disputed with other mountains. And so the bottom line is nobody really knows where this mountain is now. The memory of it has been lost. The important thing is that the experiences on Mount Sinai are recorded and quite awesome. Massive storm clouds, flashes of lightning, the audible voice of the Lord, trumpet blasts. The reactions of the people as they experienced this dramatic moment with Yahweh and Moses was often one of fear and trembling. The people were warned that the mountain of the Lord is a holy mountain. And when God's presence is there, they could not even touch the mountain. And that if they touched it, they would surely die. Do not let the priests and people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. God said only Moses can come up. He would be very specific in who was allowed to enter into his presence. He would let Aaron later come up into his presence, but it was always very specific and appointed mediators. So not only did Israel have a special calling to this intermediary role to be a kingdom of priests to the world, but Moses has a very unique status and calling with respect to his relationship to the nation of Israel. He is going to be the one through whom God will mediate his covenant. And Moses is told in Exodus chapter 19, verse 9, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak to you, and may also believe you forever." So the mighty act of God speaking to Moses in a thick cloud in the hearing and the sight of all the people of Israel is God's divine authorization that Moses is the one who mediates the covenant. In other words, the event itself says as much about Israel's calling as it does about Moses' calling, is part of the point. And one of the things that you'll see as we go through the entirety of the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, is that this story of Mount Sinai is actually recorded twice in the books. Why is it so important? Well, it's so important because the law of Moses is binding covenant between Yahweh and his people. But later generations, you know, people leak. They forget. They start to go, well, you know, why don't we have to listen to Moses? That was a long time ago that was given. Why should we care what Moses has to say about anything? Well, why? Because Moses was not speaking out of his own authority. He was God's appointed and divine ambassador. And so when Moses gave us the law and the words of the law, these were not just deep thoughts by Moses, things that he concocted of his own opinions and ideas, but these are the very words of God. And so not only is the event important, but the writing down of the event in Scripture is important. And this will become a feature of many of the prophetic writings in the Old Testament. It's called in the literary description a call narrative. It's a narrative that gives the divine ambassador, the prophet, a divine authorization. An example of a call narrative is actually in the Old Testament passage that we read this morning from Jeremiah. Jeremiah receives a calling from the Lord. Well, why is that included and why is that important in Jeremiah's writings? Because later when people go, why should we listen to you, Jeremiah? Why should we read what you have written? The divine authorization for the prophet is there in the call narrative. This didn't come from Jeremiah. God called Jeremiah to speak this and to do this. So in the book of Exodus, we have actually two call narratives. One is the call narrative of the burning bush, where Moses is sent to be the deliverer of the nation of Israel. And remember, the issue was, why should we listen to Moses? Because Moses had this experience with God at the burning bush. Why should we listen to the law of Moses, or the writings of Moses? Because of Mount Sinai. Okay. The New Testament authors of the Bible would do the same thing. And I have already spoken to this in the New Testament class, but the Mount of Transfiguration has the same function for the apostles in the Gospels. You'll remember that it was Moses and Elijah up on the Mountain of Transfiguration, the law and the prophets, with their experience of having spoken face-to-face with God before. Now it's Peter, James, and John who are up there with him. Jesus tells the apostles, don't say anything about the transfiguration until after the resurrection. Why? Because that mountaintop experience was actually given to them to be used as their divine authorization to speak the words of God. And that's precisely how Peter uses it in his second epistle. He speaks and uses the Mount of Transfiguration experience with a lot of the same language of the Mount Sinai language to give divine authorization when he says, we didn't make up or come up with these just cleverly devised myths or stories, but we were eyewitnesses. We spoke with them on the holy mountain. Again, it's a call narrative. Okay, so notice how it says that the people may believe you forever. That's, again, the idea of that this is a perpetual covenant. The covenant offered through Moses would be an everlasting covenant for future generations of Israelites long after Moses is gone. Again, this is why that's recorded in there. Now, you have this idea of a commissioned communication. A commissions B to transmit A's message to C, which then follows in the story with a little brief notice of B faithfully carrying out the commission. And you see that again and again in the Old Testament stories. Sometimes B does not carry out the commission. Moses, an example of this, is actually with Pharaoh. Moses did not communicate to Pharaoh one of the times. And you see the consequences of him not carrying out his commission. Norma mentioned Jonah. Yeah, he's told to go to Nineveh and do it, but he decides, I'm not going to be the messenger. Not a good thing to tell God you're not going to carry out his commission. But there are 36 examples of these types of stories in the Old Testament. 28 of them involve Moses. An excellent example is in 19:3-7. Which is what we've just told about. But the pervasiveness of these stories emphasize two things. Well, first they focus on the initiative and importance of the sender, who in most cases is the Lord, Yahweh. But second, they focus on the strategic role of the sendee, the ambassador of the covenant, who in most cases is Moses. And more often than not, the Lord chooses to address his people intermediately rather than immediately. He doesn't directly address his people, but he uses these divine ambassadors, such as Moses. So consider this pattern with respect to Israel's commission to be the kingdom of priests. Just as Moses is their intermediary, this is their role as the kingdom of priests and part of their calling. They are called and set apart to be the messengers of the good news of God and his reign upon earth as it is in heaven to all the nations of the world. And what should flow out of Israel is the wisdom and teachings of the way of God. And what should happen at the tabernacle and the temple complexes in Israel's future is the place where the reconciliation or the priestly role of Israel is meted out to the nations as well. And so Israel becomes, in a sense, the central place where humanity can meet God and interact with God, not only hearing God's ways and his word and instruction, but also being the place where they can find reconciliation and forgiveness and be in a right relationship with God. One of the largest places in the temple complex, and we're not there yet, but when we get there, is actually the court of the Gentiles, the court of the nations. The way that the temple was constructed was to make room for the nations of the world to come into the presence of the throne room of God. Israel is called to be a kingdom of priests. Now also, Jesus, of course, is the supreme fulfillment of this. He is the kingly priest or the priestly king in the order of Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews would argue, who now supersedes the Levitical priesthood and has once for all provided for the final sacrifice for the sins of the world. And so there's no longer any need for continued sacrifices of bulls and goats and lambs and so forth at the temple in Israel, because Jesus, once for all, has mediated a new and better covenant. The disciples are then commissioned to be the apostles as the mediators. Out, and by extension, the disciples' disciples, the church, are to take the great commission to the world and fulfill in our day the role of being the kingdom of priests. So there's continuity all through this. Starts actually in Genesis when Abraham is given the promise that he would be blessed in order that he might be a blessing to the nations of the world. But here, of course, is always the question, not only for the nation of Israel, but for us, are the sendees conveying the message that they have been entrusted to convey? In other words, is A has told B what B is supposed to tell C? Is B doing his job? Is he conveying the message? I love this passage from 2 Corinthians chapter 5. In Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. Therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, with God making his appeal through us. There's a tremendous amount of continuity in the story of the Bible, and I want you to see that and to make those connections. So right after we have the drama or the narrative of the of Mount Sinai and Moses going up and ascending to the mountain to speak with God in the cloud, God gives Moses the Ten Commandments. Only, actually, the Hebrew word is not commandment. This is interesting. It's the word word, or the ten words. We often call them the Ten Commandments, but actually, nowhere in the whole of the Old Testament is the word commandment used for these ten words. They're called words. In fact, a proof of that is, number one, you can look in your Old Testament English translations, and they will often translate it Ten Commandments, but then they'll have a footnote that says, literally, the Hebrew says, ten words. But also, in the Greek, when the Hebrew was translated to Greek, they used the words dekalogioi, which we get our word decalog, the ten words. Regardless, they are commands, or commandments, I should have put there. There's a difference between a command and a commandment. A command might be something like what God said to Abraham, go to a land that I will show you. Now that's a very specific thing that God has told Abraham. It is to be obeyed, but it is nevertheless just simply a command. A commandment is something that is perpetual and universal in its fulfillment. A commandment is something that is for all time and always to be obeyed. There's a difference between a command and a commandment. The Hebrew actually is very subtle in the way that it communicates that, but the way we make that distinction in the English translations is we say, you shall not, versus simply do this or do not do that. Do not fear is a command. And it's not quite the same as saying, you shall not fear. It's a subtle difference, but it is important. The prohibitive nature of these commandments provides certain limits on what it means to be a holy nation. Remember the three things? They were a treasured people. God demonstrated that by his rescue of them and his redemption, deliverance, and healing. They are intermediaries. They're called to be a kingdom of priests, but they also are called to be a holy nation. The special calling and the special and unique role that they have carries with it a personal responsibility to be of a character as a people that reflects well on Yahweh and what Yahweh is calling them to be. God is holy, so they are called to be holy, a holy people. And so these commandments, these words, are to be kept as limits to keep them within a holiness of life. And so the limit is clarified in order to avoid also disastrous consequences for transgressing the boundaries, as all of these kind of do-nots do when we encounter them in life. You know, you have at most swimming pools about 10 do-nots that are, yeah, do not run, do not have alcoholic beverages at the pool, do not, you know, there's always a list of do-nots, but they're for protection. They sound kind of negative and prohibitive, but they're always given to protect the people and prevent them from having consequences. The permanence of the ten words is signified by their inscription on tablets of stone. While the laws are prohibitive, you shall not, when Jesus sums up the commands or the laws, he uses the more positive performative command, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, which in a sense is a summary of the first four of the ten. To love God that passionately rules out other gods and rules out desecration of God's name and desecration of God's day. Likewise, when he says more positively, you should love your neighbor as yourself, that is, in a sense, a summary of the last six of the ten words. To love one's fellow neighbor unconditionally rules out disrespect, stealing, any violence against a neighbor, bearing false witness, or coveting. The heart of obedience to God is love, the summary of the law, which is known as the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God. We'll get to that in Deuteronomy. The summary of the law actually summarizes positively the negatives and the prohibitions of the ten. After we have the Ten Commandments, the next section is what is called the Book of the Covenant. And this actually contains a lot of more specific rules and laws. And these properly are laws. Notice in Exodus 24:3, Moses came out and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, or all the laws. And they're actually two different Hebrew words. Exodus seems to be making a distinction between the words, which is the Hebrew Debraim, and laws or rules, the Hebrew Mitzvatim, which you've heard of the Bar Mitzvah. That's where we get that word, Bar is son, Bat is daughter. Bat Mitzvah, they're having those now, but it's the commands in your son. Teach these laws, these mitzvahs, to your children. And the bar mitzvah is their opportunity to recite that they have learned the laws and learned the rules, and that's their moment. It seems like the Hebrews making a distinction, and the nature of the distinction is one, more the case laws of the Hebrew criminal code, in other words, the way that they should govern themselves as a people. And in a sense, these case laws may change with time. In other words, as circumstances change, and an example is, let me just go through the structure here, and then we'll get to the examples. But first of all, this section is structured with four main parts. This covenant law code section has four main parts. One, it starts with altar laws, and talks about the holiness and the way that they should, in a sense, come up to the altar of God. They should not have steps on the altar, so they don't reveal their nakedness as they're walking up the altar. Everything should be kept sacred and holy. So there was very specific things, such as when you make an altar to the Lord, you don't use tools on the rocks, but you have to find stones that fit perfectly, because those tools would deconsecrate those holy stones, and so on. It's very interesting, but they have very specific instructions for worship. But then you move to a section with which lawyers, I guess is the best way to say it, call casuistic case laws versus apodictic prohibitive laws. Apodictic laws have absolutely certain or necessarily true. Those are the types of laws such as you shall not steal. That's an apodictic law. A casuistic law is structured as an if-then. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. You see that? The difference is one is sort of a binding law for all time. The other is case law. It gives an example of a way that binding law should be interpreted. Does that make sense? And also becomes part of the criminal code as well, so that when somebody does violate the law and they steal a neighbor's sheep, for example, it gives the judge guidance as to how he should prosecute that law once that's broken. And so in the casuistic case law section, you'll find all of those kind of if, well, then this should happen kind of laws. And they cover a whole range of things. A lot of it has to do with the valuing of people, particularly in relationship to men and women and slaves and free people. And one of the things that was always problematic for people is that if they didn't have these kinds of rules related to the way that you treated, in a sense, the weaker people within a community, they would be abused and mistreated. And so while these laws may seem to us not as far as we would like to go with some of them, for that time period, they went very far. In other words, they very much invested in human beings, in women, and in slaves, dignity as being human beings. made in the image of God. One of the things that's very interesting is even what happens to with an unborn child. If an unborn child is, or a woman who is carrying an unborn child is wounded, and that child is born and there's a miscarriage, well, that child is treated as a human being, and that has the value of a full life and human being, and the consequences are the same as if you had murdered an adult. So it places value on those individuals that, and gives guidance to the judges who would be ruling on these cases. And what you have here are an example of the types of cases. Of course, all of these types of laws cannot, in a sense, comprehend or envision all the different ways in which people would violate or break God's ways. And so Moses had appointed 70 judges. And this is something we've already read. But those 70 judges, and Moses was serving in this way too, when there were things that were questionable aspects of the law, or when one of these types of specific infractions happened and people needed help and needed some kind of appeal process, there was order to the way that the Israelites governed things. It provided a structure for their society and the way that they should live with one another and the way that they should treat each other. The way they should treat women, slaves, aliens are very much specifically named, because these are the places where so often societies got into problems. We find this today. The reason why companies, for example, have policies is because those are the places where those companies have gotten into trouble. So policy develops and case law develops because of the precedents that are needed. You don't write laws that don't relate to real issues that people aren't struggling with. There are many similarities to the covenant code in Exodus to other Near Eastern legal codes that were written during this time, particularly the ones that were written in cuneiform, such as Hammurabi's code, which was written around 1772. Now that's several hundred years before the Mosaic Law. Moses, as a person high in the courts of Egypt, would have had very much an awareness of Hammurabi's code and these other laws that were around. Egypt was a storehouse of global knowledge. And so he would have very much had access to these things. In fact, they've discovered Hammurabi's code was made. There were many copies of that. They've discovered a copy of that in Iran. Hammurabi was a emperor of Babylon around the 1770s BC. There are significant differences, though, between these codes and the Exodus codes as well. None of these ancient codes does a deity ever speak. In other words, in Hammurabi's code, the deities, Marduk is the god, tells Hammurabi to write the laws, but it's not the deity dictating the laws. When the Ten Commandments were given, it actually is very interesting, and the Old Testament scholars debate this, but it appears from the way it's written, Moses was not used as an intermediary for the ten words, that those were said by the voice of Yahweh in their hearing, because it doesn't give that sort of commissioning structure like it does with all these other things. But those words were perhaps just dictated by God to the Israelites. And you don't have any, in the ancient law codes, you don't have deities speaking the laws. But you do in Exodus. You also, in those other law codes, do not have the historic narratives of redemption and deliverance, which is characteristic of ancient Near Eastern suzerain vassal treaties. And what's taking place here, and we'll talk more about this another time because I'm running out of time, but what's taking place throughout the entirety of the Pentateuch is God is making a covenant treaty with his people. But the covenant treaty is taking the form and the shape like treaties that kings make with their conquered peoples. This is a treaty between a king and his people, only the king is Yahweh, and not, say, Pharaoh or Hammurabi or some of these other rulers that we've talked about. And like a suzerain vassal treaty, the covenant is ratified next, and the ratification is basically where the words are read and the rules are read to the people, and people respond, every last word that the Lord has spoken we will do. In other words, they make a vow that we will keep the word, and then Moses ratifies the covenant with a blood sacrifice. So the sign of the ratification of the covenant is in blood. When Jesus says, this is my covenant, remember what he did. He took the cup of wine and he said, this is my blood of the new covenant. The continuity is there with the old covenant of Moses. We're out of time, but I'll just quickly say what comes next are instructions for the tabernacle, the blueprint for how it's to be designed and operates. Exodus devotes 13 chapters to the tabernacle and its operations. Worship is a critical component. We'll talk more about this next week. And then as you go into the Gospel of Matthew, you'll find that you're entering into the section which is called the Olivet Discourse. This is a prophetic woe oracle, is the way it starts against the Jewish leadership. It also is a prophetic statement of judgment against Israel and Jerusalem. And it holds out the hope of restoration, that the Son of Man would prevail and gather his righteous on the last day of glory. I'm going to talk a lot more about that in my New Testament class on Wednesday night.